international socialist organization, and we're co-sponsoring this event of the campaign to end the death penalty, along with the Prairie Green Party and the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. We are going to start passing a can, or rather a flowery blue basket, for your donations. Please give what you can. There's no such thing as a too small or too big donation. This teaching is being put on so that we can learn more about the historic links between the death penalty and the lynching in the United States. You will be hearing from people who have been freed from death row, and activists and scholars on the role of racism in our criminal justice system, and why the death penalty and unjust sentencing need to be abolished. I come from a Middle Eastern country where violence from the police and the conviction of innocence is pretty common. No one is really surprised to hear people getting tortured from the police, or people being convicted in the prison and just then having found innocent like 15 years later. And when I was first coming to America, I really expected things here to be different, seeing like all those shows about heroic American police. So you can imagine my surprise when I first heard about the 15-year-old unarmed boy being shot and murdered here in Champaign, and the police officer who did it basically getting away with it. And many states here in America still have the death penalty, even though my home country, which is considered a backwards third world country, has abolished it like a decade ago. The United States is the only country in the Western industrialized world that still uses the death penalty. And not only that, it is one of the countries with the highest percentage of executions, along with China, Iran, and Vietnam. In the US, nearly 3,400 people live on death row now. Since 1976, when the death penalty was reinstated, more than 1,000 people have been executed in the United States. And it's no secret that the death penalty is extremely racist. This bias extends not only to the race of defendants singled out for death sentences, but also to the race of the victims. When it comes to the death penalty, the lives of minorities are valued less than of whites. African Americans are 12% of the US population, but 42% of prisoners on death row. Although blacks constitute approximately 50% of murder victims each year, 80% of the victims in death penalty cases were white and only 14% were black. Over 18,000 executions that have taken place in this country's history, only 42 involved a white person being punished for killing a black person. The death penalty also condemns innocents to die. Since 1973, 123 people in 1525 states have been released from the death row with evidence of their innocence. Between 1900 and 1992, there were 416 documented cases of innocent persons who have been convicted of murder or capital rape, a third of whom were given a death sentence. It was discovered that 23 of these cases, the person was executed. All this information and more can be found on the CEDP website, nodeathpenalty.org. You can also learn more from the New Abolitionist newspaper, which you can pick up on your way out.
We'll pass it around. Yep. Small donation, appreciate it.
Now to our speakers. First, we'll listen to Brian Dolnar, who's with the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. After him, Mark Clements, who was a victim of Chicago police torture and trauma, followed by Marlene Martin, who is the national director of the Campaign to End the Death Penalty and also a member of the International Socialist Organization. And we will end our panel with Marvin Reeves, an exonerated Illinois prisoner. We will have plenty of time after the panel for discussion, so please say your comments and questions until after speakers are done.
Good evening. My name is Brian Dolliner, and I work with CU Citizens for Peace and Justice, and I want to thank the ISO for putting the event tonight together, and so happy to have the CEDP to town tonight. A real unique organization, and that's why I wanted to start with the example of CEDP and its work with exonerees, with former inmates. This working side by side, I think, is the best example, rather than just, and the work that we do at CU Citizens for Peace and Justice, rather than just working on behalf of individuals, we really try to work with them. And I think this collaborative model is the best. There's some socialists in the house tonight, so I want to talk a little socialist history, which is another example of this collaborative work, which is the Scottsboro case in the 1930s. The case of 9 black youth framed for raping 2 white women, one of the white women who later recanted her story. But the nine youth locked up in Scottsboro, Alabama. There several groups came immediately to their rescue. One was the International Labor Defense, backed by the Communist Party. The other, the NAACP. The NAACP said, "This is just a legal case. We'll handle it in the courts." The Communists and the ILD said, "This is more than just a legal case. It's a political case." And so worked both in and out the courtrooms and enlisted the support of the mothers of the Scottsboro boys, the Scottsboro mothers, and sent them across the country on speaking tours talking about the injustices that they had seen firsthand. And it was those powerful stories of the Scottsboro mothers, I think, which really helped turn the tide for the Scottsboro boys, who half of them were eventually released in the 30s and others later. But it's this kind of collaborative model that I want to emphasize tonight. Our group, CU Citizens for Peace and Justice, is a group of community activists, various activists of various sorts, black and white, scholars, students, people from campus, people from the community. So when Kiwan Carrington was shot on October 9th, at about 1:20, I got a call from Martel Miller. Martel, who's sort of part of our street team, longtime member of the black community, grew up here, knows about everybody in town. Martel called me at 3:00 and said somebody's been shot. The police have roped off a section around Vine. There's been a shooting. So over the weekend, Martel was able to get in touch with the family members, the woman who owned the house at 906 West Vine where Kiwan was shot, the family, the mother of the other individual who was with Kiwan, Jayshon Manning Carter, also 15, who witnessed his best friend die and then was put in the juvie hall over the weekend and currently still has charges against him. We worked with the family, with the resident 906, had a press conference the following Monday, just 3 days later, and did a press conference at the Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana. We're able to collect our own video, put it up on YouTube. You can watch it at our website, ucimc.org. The story of the family telling their story and their grief about what they seen happen before their eyes. We were able to get Deborah Thomas of 906 West Vine out to speak and say, "Kiwan stayed at my house frequently, was there over the summer, was there just that morning, had breakfast at her house, had every reason to be at her house, despite the police who got a burglary call on a non-emergency call, not 911, but a call straight to the police station. The police show up with guns drawn. The police chief was the first one there. The second, Officer Norbitz, who eventually shot Kiwan. But the police chief, understands, set the tone for what happened that day. Showing up, drawing a gun on two 15-year-old unarmed youth. Two kids who he said were bad guys when he was later interviewed, but also said they were kids. So knew that they were young. And we have, while the police have said, well, this is what we do in a routine situation like this, a burglary call, we pull guns. But we actually found departmental policy saying when dealing with juveniles, use the least amount of force required. But the authorities, the police, will never show up publicly to address any of our questions. And so the community, the family, still has many questions about what happened on October 9th. So we were able to get Deborah Thomas to give her side of the story. You can read the interview with Deborah Thomas in this month's Public Eye, which hopefully everybody has a copy of. If not, you can get them on the way out. Free newspaper out of the Independent Media Center. So we were able to talk to the family. We brought community members into our press conference, like a local youth named Smooth Rivers, who got up and spoke before the mic. So filled with emotion that day. Got up to the microphone and said, "We are out on the block every day, coming and going. I leave my house and the police call me by my name." All right. Questioning them, he says, "We're out being harassed every day out on the block. We got this. You can look at on our video online. December 8th, the state's attorney, Julia Reitz, came out with her determination after reading the state police report, said that this was an accident, that there was this was not first-degree murder, it was not involuntary manslaughter. It was an accident. But even before this, the local city manager in Champaign, Steve Carter, and the News Gazette, seemingly all working together, all in chorus, saying, this is an accident, this is an accident, this was an accident. So we are trying to get further intervention in the case. There is a civil suit that's been filed by James Montgomery out of Chicago, a high-powered lawyer. We are following and doing follow-up. And we're also watching the case of Jayshon Manning Carter, the other 15-year-old who's still alive. There's the literal lynching, the murder on the spot of Kiwan Carrington. But then there's also the legal lynching by what the communists in the 1930s called the capitalist courts, that's still underway. And so I'm going to circulate a petition that we have today to drop all the charges on Jayshon Manning Carter. He's being charged with felony resisting a peace officer. We FOIA'd information from the state's attorney of all such cases directed at juveniles resisting a peace officer, found that of the 24 charges, felony, juvenile, resisting a peace officer, 24 charges over a 22-month period, 22 were against African Americans. And the other two, the race was unidentified. So this seems to be a law selectively used against black youth. Mm-hmm. All right. And we're able to prove this. And yet still no response, still no questions being answered by the local authorities. We had 1,700 signatures and delivered them last week to the state's attorney, Julia Reitz. 1,700 signatures brought before. I asked her personally, what do you have any response to the 1,700 people who signed the petition? She said no. But when she got in front of the cameras, who she invited back to her office, I was not allowed, but she invited all the rest of the members of the local media back to their office and told the media, these people collecting the signatures, don't pay them much mind. They're lazy. They should be out doing volunteer work at the local schools instead. So we don't think we're lazy, and we are continuing to do the hard work like everybody here tonight. So I'm going to pass around this petition to drop the charges on Jayshon Manning Carter. If you have any more questions, happy to answer any of them.
I did not commit. I was considered as a juvenile offender that was sentenced to natural life for a fire that occurred on the south side of Chicago, which resulted in the loss of life of four individuals. You know, I'm looking at some of you here today, and you're very young. I was caught into a system of racism, and the racism was that a commander by the name of John Burge out of Chicago, they would arrest African Americans and Latinos and take them to the police station and beat and torture them to repeat or sign confessions. In most cases, if there were witnesses, these witnesses were individuals that were pressured to cooperate with the state. In my particular case, there was no witnesses. There was a document which was a confession that was used against me, and in the confession, it totally made no common sense. This confession caused me not only to be tried, but to be convicted of something that I did not commit. Time and time again, African Americans and Latinos would go in front of judges within the Cook County area, and they would explain to these judges that they had been beat and that they had been tortured. Well, it was not just a race collective of judges, meaning just white judges or Latinos, but all races of judges, that they basically ignored the fact what people was coming and telling them. And a lot of it had to do with that many of the judges which serve in capacity today, they are individuals that were either once Cook County state's attorneys, put it this way, prosecutors in general. And their whole perspective is to protect the integrity of the prosecutor's office at any cost. And what ended up happening is that many more individuals beyond my conviction went on to be tortured in similar fashions to the way of what occurred to me and in other more gross areas, as far as individuals being electrical shock with in their genitals and in their testicles. Some were beat with telephone books placed over their legs or over their chest or head. Some was even sexually assaulted with cattle prongs. This kind of justice went on in the Cook County area for more than 20 years. There were men going in front of judges and explaining to them what had occurred. Most judges, they turn their ears or turn their eyes to the cry of what individuals were saying. As expressed to you, I was a juvenile. Therefore, I was sentenced to what most individuals may know as juveniles that were sentenced to natural life without the possibility of parole. Being a torture victim, the campaign to end the death penalty came together as they built a group which was called the Family Network, or something like that, Julian, the Family Network. Okay, and what they did was they began to aggressively protest against John Burge and what 67 other detectives had done to African-American suspects. There were only 40 of these detectives that was questioned under a federal grand jury. It turned out that, well, this was a state subpoenas under Needleman, I mean, under Egan. And it was a report that revealed that many African Americans, over 100, had been beaten, tortured by police. The sad reality of this is that there are still men that are still locked up inside of the Illinois Department of Corrections that basically need young, energized individuals to come behind them and to fight with them to basically reveal their plights. It's not a question as to whether men were beat. The question now lies upon, will the system now do what is right? The system lied to the public as ways to be elected into public office and claimed that they would correct this. One of those officials was Lisa Madigan. Lisa Madigan has moved very slow. The Cook County State's Attorney's Office has moved even more so slow. So this has allowed for other individuals that should be released to remain inside of the Illinois Department of Corrections. I also serve in the capacity as the campaign to end the death penalty. I basically like took Julian's job as a administrator and as a board of directors, okay, against the death penalty. I basically became more heavily involved against the death penalty after A woman by the name of Frances Newton out of Texas, she was sentenced to die as a result of allegedly killing her family. Well, the evidence was tainted in that particular case. The police chief did agree that there should be testing, but due to the fact that all of the evidence was mixed in, they could not give an adequate testing. But rather than Texas sparing this woman, not really knowing if she committed the crime or not knowing if she did not commit the crime, they went on and they carried out the death sentence and they killed her. This is the problem which most poor people face. In other words, the system reaches a conclusion to move fast and swiftly against them, opposed to giving them really their day in court. I'm also fighting against approximately 109 kids that were sentenced to natural life in prison. This is a fight which ties in with the death penalty due to the fact that individuals that are 13, 14, 15, all the way up to 17 years of age, they have been literally sentenced as children to the Department of Corrections to die. Most people are under this myth that a natural life sentence means 20 years. Well, natural life means forever. So in other words, this means that these young men, it's one man in particular by the name of Adolfo Davis, and he played a very minor role, something as a lookout man. And as being a lookout man, he received a natural life term. So, in other words, we are a society that is saying that if a kid makes one mistake, lock him up and throw away the key. And we're not looking at an opportunity of rehabilitation towards those kids. What we're basically saying is that this particular group of kids cannot be rehabilitated. Now, if we're saying that, then that means that every individual inside of this room should report to your nearest prison and turn yourself in because something you have done. So my point being is that these are two, really three, very difficult fights. The John Birch fight, the fight to end the death penalty, and the fight to end juveniles from being sentenced to natural life. Very three hard, complicated fights due to the fact, one, we have crime activists, crime victim activists that are fighting us day and night due to the fact that what they're saying is that if a judge gives you a particular sentence, you should do it and serve it, you know, basically shut up and bam. Well, they're not looking at the fact that the biggest criminal in history is Richard M. Daley, the mayor of the city of Chicago, as well as people like John Birch. John Birch literally knocked on victims' doors and said, hey, we caught the killer who killed your family member. Sent those victim families through torture, through a complete court process. Now comes to find out maybe 20 to 30 years ago, I mean later down the road, that these individuals did not commit the crime. Have he given an apology? No. Have these people stood up and faced the reality that what occurred in the African-American and Latino community, I don't care, you can say obstruction of justice, you can go on and you can scream, what's the other one, perjury, but the biggest crime is racism. And it was racism because these were all white detectives, 64 white detectives. Matter of fact, the commander of John Birch was a black commander, who later went on to become to be the superintendent. John Birch would call him the N-word frequently. Now we must face the reality that we had a black mayor that promoted John Birch to commander and to the highest decorative award that has ever been given to a police officer. So now we have to really shake our heads and wonder, what are we battling? Are we battling inter-racism? Because let me tell you, guess what? White or black, if you poor, you are poor. If you are rich, you are rich. And let me tell you, they're not looking at racism. They holding hands and skipping down the street. Only does the poor fight among each other. So that's something that we need to figure out, correct, and not only correct, but to get involved. The campaign against the death penalty, we do have sustainer forms if you would like to donate to our cause to constantly fight against the death penalty and other issues. We also have forms where that if you would like to be contacted by us or else join the campaign to end the death penalty, because this is a very, all of this is very difficult and tiresome. So I do appreciate y'all inviting me here to speak, and I just ask that all of you get involved. All of y'all got Facebooks and various other things where that y'all communicate. You have MySpace and you blog. Come on. How about blogging about seeing in this room someone who has spent 28 years, someone who has spent 21 years in prison? Because let me tell you, guess what? I could have been your father. Then you'll be talking about, guess what? Why I didn't help him. But why should we sit like a log right up on that wall and wait till we get knocked down? Then we come run to the organization talking about, hey, I need some help. By that time, it's too late. Okay? But thank you and God bless you.
Mark's great note. I'm going to pass around or ask our wonderful chair to pass these around. It's our newsletter of the campaign, and there's a speech in there, Marvin's speech at our recent convention, and also some quotes in there from Mark and pictures. So if you can give 50 cents or a dollar, that helps defray the cost of publishing that. You can see that I only brought actually 25 copies of our newsletter, really not expecting to have, you know, all these folks in the room, so it's really wonderful. We can certainly get you guys a copy.
I'll
give
y'all self a hand.
Yeah.
We
walked over here and it was freezing, and we were saying, you know, this is so cold, you know, we wouldn't be coming up. Also, if you want to join our listserv, we have a national listserv, and we post things around about the death penalty or juvenile LWOP or whatever. So if you want to join that, I'll pass out a couple of sheets around too, and we hope that you'll sign up on that as well. Okay, so, so just to say a little bit about lynching then, lynching now. Well, one thing I wanted to say is that Mark and I recently went just a few days ago, we went and heard Simeon Wright speak at a local library. He's the cousin of Emmett Till, and he was in the bed with Emmett. He was a young boy, and he was in the bed the night that Emmett was taken from his bed and lynched that night. And he spoke about that whole ordeal, what he and his family lived through. He talked about the three white men coming in and how his mother never ever could go back to that house, how his father, you know, against the horrible racism of the South, stood up in court and said, there he is, when they asked if he could see the men and the courage that it took for his father to do it. And yet what do we know? We know what happened was that it was a not guilty verdict that came down, and they were acquitted, and they swaggered with, you know, their white pride that they could get by. And I was thinking when we were sitting there and we were listening to Simeon speak about how today, really, when you look at the death penalty in our criminal justice system, that it might not be people coming in so nakedly and taking people out, but in the same kind of way, it is the criminal justice system snatching up young black men and dragging them off to prison, maybe not in white robes, maybe in black robes, hammering a gavel with law books in front of them. But it really is the same kind of thing. Lynching from a tree was a spectacle, you know, that we saw that was quite popular in the late 1800s. And one year, more than 150 people were lynched. I mean, thousands of people were lynched in the South. Postcards were made of these events. Sometimes people would take souvenirs of people's body parts from lynchings. Newspapers sometimes advertised these events. And we look back at this, and we look back at it in horror. How could it be that that happened? And I hope that one day we'll look back at this, and we'll say, how could these things have happened? How could it be that John Burge, who tortured people, you know, and why was it that these things could, you know, John Burge, you heard what Mark said, you know, tortured people in the most horrific ways. And these, over 24 of these men are still languishing in prison. Graylin Johnson, who had his head stuck into a toilet bowl choking as the police officers urinated in there. He is still in prison. Typewriter bags covered until they suffocated and blacked out. That happened to Aaron Patterson. That happened to Stanley Howard, who still remains in prison. Largely, you know, these men were sent, some of them to death row, many to prison, largely based on these confessions that were tortured from them. Reginald Mahaffey was hung out of a window and accidentally dropped. He suffers permanent brain damage as a result of that. He still remains incarcerated. I hope that one day we'll look back at this and it will be a relic of the past. Now, we're hoping that John Burge, who is finally coming to court in May, we plan to greet him, we hope that they slap the cuffs on that man and finally put the real criminal in prison. And we hope to win justice for those remaining in prison. He's been on his boat in Florida receiving full pension. He was fired because it was a scandal in Chicago and it was a ruckus. And he was finally fired in 1993. But he went to Florida where he retired and he gets like $3,000 a month. He enjoys himself in Florida, and he wakes up and has his cup of coffee. He can go fishing on his little fishing boat, which, guess what he named it? The Vigilante. No lie. Okay? So, you know, but yet the men remain in prison that, you know, were under his reign and tortured. You know, we can't tolerate this as a society. We have to speak up against it. We have to organize against it, and that's part of why we're here today, and we want to get that message out, and we want to put pressure on him, and we want to win justice for the remaining people in prison. The lynching goes on. It goes on today, as we said, the legal lynching in the form of the death penalty. People probably have heard of the case of Troy Davis. He's on death row in Georgia. You know, he's still, you know, yes, he did win something from the Supreme Court, but even as his sister says, it's still going to be an uphill battle. We get to keep our eyes on that. This is outrageous. And again, what does it come down to? We see it over and over again about police torturing and threatening and coercing people to testify against people. And he had 7 people that have come out to recant, and only 9, anyways, but 7 people have come out to say, I was pressured, I felt threatened by the police, and that's why I said it was Troy, it wasn't Troy. And that was what largely sent him to death row. Rodney Reed, who's on death row in Texas, he is really the classic case of someone who is legally lynched today. He was convicted by an all-white jury. His only crime was having a relationship with a white woman who was engaged to a police officer. And he remains incarcerated and faces execution. So we're fighting around that case as well. I wanted to say just something a little bit about our criminal justice system, because, you know, we say that, you know, it's really like, it's maybe not as blatant as hanging somebody from a tree. It is more hidden from the public eye, but it still goes on. 20% of all those executed were tried by all white juries. Of the 2.3 million people that are incarcerated, 60% are black and Latino. And we have to remember that blacks and Latinos, for the same crime, study after study shows that blacks and Latinos get much harsher sentences than those that are white. So racism, as Mark was saying too, it just underlines the whole criminal justice system. 25% of all cases where people have been exonerated made false confessions. Mark's one of them. Many people who were later found to be exonerated made false confessions. So I just wanted to say a little bit about, you know, what is it that we can do about it? And we do talk about looking back in the day when lynchings occurred. And I just wanted to say one more thing, because you have to sort of ask a question, why did lynching take place? What was the purpose of it? Because I think we also have to ask some underlying questions about, maybe the discussion will get to some of that. What is the purpose of such a repressive tool like the death penalty and like incarcerating 2.3 million people, mostly those that are of people of color and people that are poor? Why is it that we need that in the society? Why is it that this country, the best country, you know, in the world, and yet we incarcerate way more than any other country, and yet our crime levels are actually higher than most. So why is it, and what purpose does it serve? And when you look back at lynching, you have to ask yourself the same question: why was it? Well, after the Civil War, people know that there was a short period called Reconstruction, where actually blacks were making some gains in the South. And people, you know, the planter class, the upper class, they didn't like that. They didn't want blacks to be able to vote, to be able to run for office, and they were starting to do that. There was public education and so on. Things were actually starting to change and look a little bit better for blacks. They didn't want that. Here's what one racist governor of South Carolina said at the time. "We of the South have never recognized the right of the Negro to govern white men, and we never will. We have never believed him to be the equal of the white man, and we will not submit to his gratifying his lust on our wives and daughters without lynching him." So that became the myth, right? They're raping our white women and so on. And this became a really pervasive myth and a justification to hang people. It was a way of terrorizing the black community. It was a way of terrorizing and making them feel that they were less and not equal to white people. And it was a way to create fear so that they would not want to exercise their rights as human beings. Unfortunately, they were left to do that. The federal government didn't help to stop that. So when you look at it, it was really an intention of a reimposition of white supremacy in the South. That was what really lynching was about. And I would argue that, in a way, lynching has just been brought inside to the courtrooms and inside our criminal justice system, but serves much the same purpose. So lastly, I'll just end on, because I got the wrap-up sign, which is fine, because, you know, I'm anxious to hear what you all have to say, too. And actually, that's really what I wanted to say, too, is that as much as, well, not what I'm saying, but what other folks are saying up here tonight, as much as that's interesting and they have some horrific stories and what they've lived through, I mean, that's part of what we do with the tour, part of what we do in the campaign to end the death penalty, is to try to, you know, before they were out, I mean, it's great to have them out, but before that it was their family members that we worked with. We would have arranged call-ins for them to call in and talk to audiences and to try to, you know, the people themselves that are living through the horror, they're the best people to speak out against it, and we want to join and try to figure out how to expose their voices and so on. And as much as they're very interesting, really tonight it is about you. It's going to depend on what you guys make of this meeting. Like Mark said, you put it on Facebook. It's a decision that you all make, whether you found this interesting and decide to do something about it, decide to join up in whatever way or capacity. Doesn't have to be with a campaign, but in something that you decide that this is not going to be tolerated anymore. When you look at the past and lynchings, there was a woman, Ida B. Wells, and she just decided, even against, you know, all the odds, that she was going to go down there and do investigative journalism. And she put the myth, she exposed the myth about, you know, that blacks were not being lynched because they were raping white women. She went down there and she interviewed people and she wrote about it and she told the stories and she told the truth and she exposed it. And you know what? Time and time again, when you look at history, you find out that when people organized against it, they were able to make changes. We know that it has to be blacks, whites together, and that we can do it. We can organize together to fight. They did it fighting, you know, at the abolition of slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and I think today we need to have that kind of a movement to keep it real and to fight back. Now today you can see that we have a black president, but I don't think that, you know, any one of us would argue that racism is over. But what does it really mean? And I would argue that it doesn't mean we're going to win justice by any one particular person in office. It's going to mean we're going to have to organize and we're going to have to fight for it. Whether it's a black in office or whether it's a white, it's going to matter if we organize and push back. In this country, as Martin Luther King once said, you know, why is it that we have to pay for water when the world is made of two-thirds part water? So I would argue that you have to look beyond the surface of things and ask why. Why do we incarcerate so many for so long? Why do we continue to use the death penalty? What is the reason? Why is it that 1 out of 10 are unemployed in this country and that the brunt of that is felt with blacks and Latinos? They're unemployed at a much higher rate than whites. Why can we afford to bail out? Why can we afford to fund two wars but not our school system? Why do we bail out the banks, but we have no money for people facing foreclosures? What are our society's priorities? And I just think that those are some of the questions that I hope we'll get at tonight. I'm an anti-racist criminal justice fighter, but I'm also a socialist. And I urge all of you in the room together tonight to get together on this issue, and hopefully we can begin to take the steps of rebuilding the kind of movement that it's going to take in this country to win some gains and build a different kind of society, one that's based on human need and not corporate greed, something that doesn't need repressive tools like the death penalty and long prison sentences. Thank you. And now Marvin Reeves. Woo! Woo!
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Marvin Reeves. I'm a survivor of torture. Also serving 21 years in prison. We all agree that racism is in America. We all agree that it exists today. Y'all got to forgive me because I'm a little emotional. When I come out and I see crowds of people, it's like therapy to me. Mm-hmm. And it makes me feel like the world is interested in what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
And I want to tell y'all just a small part of my story. I was accused of killing two women, three children. Some that I loved dearly. I was raised by my mom and my sister. So women is very important, and kids can do no wrong. So you can imagine the burden that I carried on me when they told me I was accused of that crime. And the sad part about it, a guy was in jail doing time for a burglary that he committed. Called him and told him, a couple of my friends killed these people I seen in the news. Let me tell y'all something. That was too easy. Mm-hmm. To me, that was too easy. Can you imagine somebody calling and telling that you commit a crime and they come get you out your bed? Not the regular police, the SWAT team. Kick my door in. Guns on me, my sister. I go outside, it's helicopters. They all on the roof with AK-47. I say, why? I would have walked to the police station if I knew y'all wanted to talk to me. Y'all didn't have to come get me like that. Till this day, my family still traumatized by it. Mm-hmm. My kids screaming, hollering. I didn't get a chance to see them grow up. When I look out and I see y'all, I think about how I didn't see my kids go to college. And it bothers me. Looking at me, you would never be able to tell I was a General James. But they say you tell on yourself by the things that you do. You tell on yourself by the things that you eat. I like candy. My favorite picture is The Wizard of Oz. I like to see Dorothy go home. It's a Wonderful Life. I love that picture. Dreams come true. So now that you know that about me, don't let this face fool you. Because walking down the street, this face is killing. But in actuality, I'm the same guy that will help you cross the street. I'm the same guy, if I seen you in trouble, I'll help you. But they didn't know that about me. And guess what? They didn't kill me. The people that I was accused of killing, they fought the Chicago police. So you can imagine the beating I took. My eyes is not dark like this here because I'm dark-skinned. If you look closely, them permanent black eyes from the beating I took from the police. Then, when I got to the county, guess what? They whole family worked to death. It was county sheriffs, cousins and uncles. So for about a year, I fought every day. Getting kicked on, getting stomped on. And I'm steady wondering why. This is America. Why this happened to me? Guy called and said I killed some people. And I guess what really hurt me the most, when I was at the police station. You know what they told me? They said, we know you didn't do it. But we think you had something to do with it. And we're going to send you black so-and-so to jail anyway. And it bothered me in America today that these type of things would happen. Because I'm an honest guy. I believe in truth. I believe in loyalty. You know what I mean? So therefore, I would never tell a lie. And I wouldn't harm a flea. But they didn't know that about me because they didn't care about me. And when they came and got me out of my bed and took me to jail, I started asking questions. I said, well, wow, this is America. Mm-hmm. We stand firm on the world about torture. Mm-hmm. But we don't stand firm in our backyard. This guy, John Burns, tortured suspects for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And Mayor Davis said he didn't know nothing about it. I'm the district attorney before he was the mayor. Mayor Davis was the district attorney before he was the mayor. But he had to sign on the dotted line for all those victims that were tortured. I got a transcript where he gave a stool pigeon $1,000 to lie on me. Signed his name. But he said he don't know nothing about it. You can catch him in action right today. What about those torture victims up under John Bruce? Well, I don't know nothing about it. But you the mayor. Where does the accountability come in? Mm-hmm. Happen on your watch. You supposed to be held accountable. It just bothered me. It did something to me. Being in America and know that we stand firm on our conviction. I said to myself, I'm sitting in that cell. I'm writing letters. I grew up, I'm much older guy than a lot of young guys. I grew up in the Black Panther days with the activists. Okay, I know a little bit about activists. I write letters to the activists I know. Reverend Meeks, Jesse Jackson, Operation Push. Man, they got me locked up for killing some women and kids I don't know nothing about. I get a letter back, say, well, we think you need a lawyer. Think you need a lawyer? I need help. I need more than a lawyer. I need help. I filed my last appeal. Like all my other appeals, I thought we were going to come back tonight. I like to watch the news. That's how a lot of guys in prison find out what's going on around the world. Watch the news. I see some people standing down there at the Thompson Center, shirts on and signs. Free Marvin Reed. What are these people? I know these people. But for some reason, they know me. I didn't know my co-defendant that was on death row was part of a group called the Death Row Team. And they was involved with the campaign, the end of death penalty, that involved my man. And I said to myself, believe me, I'm a good guy. I'm the type of guy that'll come to your house if ain't no TV there, I'm gonna buy you one. If ain't no food in the refrigerator, I'm gonna put some food there. And don't let the kids be there, oh my gosh, you get to go to the grocery store. You feel me? I'm that type of guy. I said to myself, when I seen them, Lord have mercy. I didn't see none of my friends. People that I spent my money on. They didn't care about me having my own tow truck, having my own shop, working hard every day for my kids, but I got six of them. Love them dearly. Wouldn't trade them for nothing in the world. Do anything for them. They didn't care about none of that. All they care about is get that MF and put them in jail. Like, wow. By a show of hands in this room, if anybody in your family or friend was wrongfully convicted of a horrible crime and sent to death row, raise your hand. How many of you know how to help? Two people. More than I got, because I didn't know. I didn't know how to help myself. And my family didn't know how to help me. My mama gave up her Social Security that she worked for all her life to a lawyer that I could have did better than him. So, you know, I was like a lost ball in high heels. Couldn't find my way out. But I believe in miracles, and I believe in second chance. And the fight that they put up for me is one of the reasons why I'm here today. Mm-hmm. And I say to anybody out there, in order to make a change, you got to make a difference. Because it's me today. It might be somebody you know tomorrow. Wouldn't wish that bad luck on them. Learn how to fight the enemy. In life, we learn that there's good and bad. When you're on the good side, you got to tussle with the bad side. The bad side is enemy. Learn your enemy. When you learn your enemy, learn your strategy. Mm-hmm. When you learn your strategy, you conquer the world. Believe. And that's what it took to get me home. Once we learn the enemy, we put the strategy together. And I'm here to talk to y'all today. It's a beautiful thing. Very beautiful. Mm-hmm. Wow. Y'all just don't know how I feel. Mm-hmm. I done been to hell and back. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels good to be here amongst y'all. My co-defendant, I wish he was here to tell y'all a story. Because he was a young guy. I was 29. He was 29. I weighed 200 pounds. He weighed 175 pounds. Little guy. Way smaller than I. Mm-hmm. I wished I could tell y'all some of the things he did to me, but I don't want to upset y'all. I was there. I seen it. I didn't know that people like that existed in America. Ugly man is an ugly thing. You know, if y'all don't know nothing else, get involved. Join the campaign. Don't have to be campaigning in there, Philly. Because one day you're going to want to stand up for something. They're not going to hear you. But guess what? They'll hear y'all. 1,000 voices, they'll hear.
Mm-hmm.
Just like they heard them crying about me. Get involved.
Now, before we move on to discussion, does anybody have any announcements that they want to make?
Did everybody get a chance to sign the petition? Did it make it out to the back outer regions over there? Raise your hand if you want to sign the petition, you didn't get a chance. Okay. Everybody signed the petition. Thank you very much. Okay, give it to Roger.
Eric?
Yeah. I'm part of the Undergraduate Graduate Alliance, and on March 4th, the Undergraduate Graduate Alliance, along with the GEO, the Campus Faculty Association, and the Campus Labor Coalition, will be marching on Swanland Administration Building to demand a new, more democratic and more just public university. I have some pamphlets here. It's part of the National Public Day. It's part of the National Day of Action to defend public education. It's coming out of California, but there are people all over the country who are coming together to stand against the corporatization and the dehumanization that is happening on our campuses across the nation. So if anyone's interested, I'll be passing these around. I don't have that many, so. But if you're interested, come and talk to me after the meeting.
Exactly.
Just so people know, the Campus Anti-War Network conference, actual conference, is going to be this weekend here on campus. And it's just going to be like, since, you know, we all know the wars are still going on, the Democratic administration has not, you know, ended the wars and in fact has escalated the war in Afghanistan. So, you know, there's going to be, the conference this weekend is going to be, you know, a lot of this political discussions about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the occupation of Palestine. And so, you know, if people are interested in making it out to that, it's going to be most of the talks and plenaries are going to be in Gregory Hall, which is this building, on Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. and going all the way to like 8:39, and then Sunday there will be discussions as well. So just want to let people know about that, and that the final talk on Saturday will be given by Michael Schwartz, who wrote this book, War Without End. It's, you know, it's a discussion of the wars that the U.S. has been perpetrating, again, all across the world. So the other announcement I wanted to say is just that there's a local effort to have a demonstration, a rally and demonstration on March 18th, which is near the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And so the idea is just to have it out here on campus. And the meeting, the next meeting for that, if anybody's interested in getting involved with that, the next meeting will be at the lunch break during the Campus Anti-War Network Conference, which will be, I believe, 1:30 to 2:30. So, talk to me if you're interested in involved with that.
All right.
Oh, can I just make a quick announcement? I'm just going to pass this around. If you got a newsletter and you can put in 50 cents, I appreciate it.
You put my name in if you didn't.
Yeah, that's true too. We're happy for a donation.
To bring it back to what Brian was talking about earlier with the Jayshon Manning case, Planners Network will be having a sort of a subcommittee that will be organizing. I've been doing a lot of organizing on campus. We had a teach-in event a couple weeks ago, but we're going to be doing more teach-ins, so you can come find out about it. Also, we'll be working with CUCPJ, which meets on Saturdays at 4 at the IMC. But if you want to get involved in the Jay Sean Manning case, I'll be here after. You can just give me your email. I'll shoot you some information. But we will talk about what happened, get you all the information. But if you're interested in getting involved in working on campus, we got probably 1,200 of the signatures from campus. So there's a lot of people that are interested, but not enough people who are organizing around the issue. So please get involved, and that's our local issue right now that relates to social justice and to the legal system.
Yeah, I just wanted to make an announcement about the, I mean, we've been hearing a lot about what the corporate parties of America have done for criminal justice in the United States, the Democrats and the Republicans, Daley, Bush, et cetera. So there is an alternative. There's several alternatives, but one I'm involved with is the local Green Party. So we're going to be trying to push the campaigns for Lee Allen Jones for Senate and Rich Whitney for governor this November. Whitney ran last time. He got 10% of the vote establishing the party. That's with two months of campaigning. So now we've got a whole year, and we're going to take Springfield. If you want to help support a candidate that wants to abolish the death penalty, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If you want to support a candidate that wants to institute a state bank so we can invest in people, not profit, to invest in a candidate that supports universal health care, bringing back our National Guard troops from Iraq, and ensuring that our educational system isn't funded based on how profit or how much money their neighbors make, then I encourage you to talk to me and figure out how you can support Whitney and the Green Party. And we'll be bringing him to campus at the beginning of April, so if you want to work on that event. Mm-hmm.
Now, moving on to discussion, please raise your hand. It's a crowded room, and I'm short, so raise your hand really high. I'll put you on the list, and I'll call on you, so feel free to raise your hand, even when someone else is speaking. So.
My name is Elizabeth, and I just want to encourage people that when we're talking, I know that one of the things that happens, and I'm a little bit older than some people here, is like, well, what do we do walking away? You all advocated, right? Do something. So I encourage people to share their stories of, okay, what can be done, right? What are the steps? Because maybe you don't know somebody who's on death row, although you can find out. And the two things I want to offer towards that are, well, three things. One is writing to a person on death row, writing to a prisoner in general, who are isolated, right? They don't have a lot of, they don't know. Maybe you see something on the news, but maybe not. The letters to the editor is the most read section of the newspaper, and it's one of the ways to share the stories and kind of change the public thing, so write a letter to the editor. But a key thing about it is when you see police interactions, to at least just witness it and be there to show that you're watching. And you can even say, hey, how are things going? Which is weird and we'll throw them off, but it's a way of showing, I see what's going on and I'm paying attention, or connecting with the person and say, hey, here's my number. If anything's going on, call me. I'm a witness, whatever. So those are my pieces, but I encourage people to share, how are you going to walk forward with this, right?
And if I can say, piggybacking on Beth's comment about how do you get in touch with an inmate? You can do that through Books to Prisoners. There's a couple representatives. Jane is right. Raise your hand for me, Jane. And Judith back in the corner, who both work with Books to Prisoners out of the IMC. They send books to all the 27 prisons throughout Illinois and our 47,000 inmates, and those are people who can help put you in touch with sending books.
I have kind of a comment on that being a witness thing. I think if you're Caucasian, that's a really great option. But if you're a minority, depending on what minority group you're a part of, that might escalate the problem. To say, like, hey, I'm watching you. So, I mean, maybe being a witness and watching, but not necessarily getting personally involved, just depending on the situation and, like, understanding, because you don't want to make things worse for that person, and you don't want to make things worse for yourself. Another question. There was there was a man who was convicted. I don't know what, but he had relations with a woman who was engaged to a police officer. What was the...
Oh, Rodney Reed.
Yeah, Rodney Reed.
What was the charge?
Of rape and guilt.
She got killed.
Yeah,
yeah,
she was killed. I'm sorry, yeah. And we have all stuff on there on our website too, www.covid.org, and I believe this is in our recent one. His mom spoke out at our convention. We have a lot of stuff on it, so if you're interested, email me.
The woman in the front, then we'll go to the back.
I have a question about the organizing side of what you all do in terms of having multiple cases going at multiple times. How do you, I guess, get people, are people organizing around various cases, or is it the larger issue, and then how do you get people involved?
Okay, so basically the campaign has chapters in different areas. So, you know, the first step, and, you know, when Marvin, he, you know, it was great because at Naperville when we spoke out, he's like, how many people, you know, would know what to do if somebody was snagged up in the criminal justice system? And what I said, too, is like, when I first got involved in this, we really didn't know what to do either. We just looked at the civil rights movement, we saw it, and we were outraged what was happening, but we didn't really know what to do, although we did know that we wanted to do it kind of in the model of Scottsboro. We knew that we wanted to work with prisoners, not on behalf of, like, social workers. But we really didn't know what to do. So it was just listening, being patient, getting a group of people together and just trying to kind of plot it out. So that's sort of what happens. And it naturally grew up around the Bird stuff because so many of them were in prison. When I went to visit them in prison, I started to hear the stories about what they were telling me. And they were the ones that formed a group in prison, the Death Row 10, his co-defendant. So it was both organizing on the inside and the outside, which kind of brought it about. So we have a group in Texas. We have, like, small chapters around the country. So in Texas, of course, they're bombarded because there's so many executions that go on. But what they do is they do try to highlight certain cases, and it depends on family members and who kind of shows interest and gets involved. Then we hold meetings, and we decide what to do. They have done, I mean, I was just talking to Lily the other day, who organizes in Texas. And she's like, if they tried to execute Rodney Reed, they would have a hard time because they have really put the word out. They've gotten the word out. They do demonstrations with the families and so on. So it kind of depends on the chapter itself, wherever it's located, what they do. And then once a year we come together. So we all, and we have a newsletter, so we're all kind of familiar with each other's cases. And then there's some that go, that we all organize around, like Troy Davis or Mumia and cases like that. So, did that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Blue coats in the back?
Obviously, no one can give you back years on your life, but are there fair compensation packages for the exonerated?
When you say fair, what do you mean?
I'm just interested in, I mean, like, what your, do you feel it was fair? I mean, I'm just, because I know that there are compensation packages,
yeah.
But I'm not sure, like, how that works or if it's even a fair process.
Well, believe it or not, in order to get that money, you got to jump through hoops. That money got to be passed through. First, you got to file a petition. Then it have to be passed through the Senate. It have to be passed through the House. Then the governor got to sign. Guess what? If you ain't got no connections, you ain't going to get it. But I'm proud to tell you. I got mine last week, and I put it in the bank and walked away and left it there. $99,150.
So how did they calculate
that? I'd give $100 million for my life back.
I think $10,000 a year.
$10,000 a year.
He's going to go on with a civil suit, and we're going to read about him getting millions of dollars sometime. He'll deserve
everything. One other thing I'd like to share with y'all. Mark say they don't apologize.
Right.
But let me be the first person to show y'all a certificate that the judge signed that he hated. A certificate of innocence.
Mm-hmm.
See what this is? Mm-hmm. A certificate of innocence. Say Mr. Reeves didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
This paper is good anywhere, in the United States. Signed by the highest judge. Thank you.
EB1. Death penalty cases and cases of life imprisonment get and need a lot of attention. But for every one of those, there must be many, many more. You know, when the kid was shot here by police this last fall, countless people came up and spoke in front of the city council, despite the risk, and said, you know, things like this are happening all the day, not every day, not people getting shot, but the police are harassing them all the time. I mean, it must be a large fraction of the people who were in prison who have been, you know, put through the mill like this. I mean, how can we understand that? That's one question.
I think we as a public have to stand on the people that we elect in office. Because, I mean, like, I grew up in a different time. I grew up in a time where we had an officer in the neighborhood that we know as Officer Friendly. He came by your house. He came by your school. He knew who everybody was. Not like the police officers today. I don't understand what they're doing. They're doing more gangbanging than they're doing anything. And the only thing I think about a lot of time is when I see the police car ride past. If you ever been in Chicago, the first thing you notice is on the side of the police car, it says serve and protect. My question to him is, who is you serving and who is you protecting?
Right. Yeah, I'd just like to suggest something to think about. Talk about this transition of. It's just something to think about when you talk about this transition in the way policing is done in the United States. Mm-hmm. I did casework at Cabrini Green in the 1960s. I had a tough time getting the cops to come in to protect. My people, my clients. What I think has changed fundamentally is that there was this conception of policing as war. You had the war on crime, you had the war on drugs, and certain populations got identified as an enemy population. And police began to organize themselves with SWAT teams, getting armored cars. Champaign police have 2 armored cars they use. With high automatic weapons, with the kind of dress that is military dress. So it's a replication internally, domestically, of the sort of wars that are fought externally. So when we have an anti-war movement, we ought to be thinking domestically as well as internationally.
And of course, Sergeant Burge was former Vietnam vet himself.
He learned torture in Vietnam.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Electricity picked it up in Vietnam.
I have Rohit and Abdul.
I'm glad that you raised that point, because what I was thinking was that there are several states that have abolished the death penalty. And there is this notion that, and a lot of people perhaps support the abolition of the death penalty also, because there is this notion that, oh, you can just keep them in prison, you know, we don't need to kill them, which sort of takes the attention away from systematic racism and systematic problems. The other point was how you raised the question of why is it that we need so many millions of people in prison? I don't know, it's bizarre that on the one hand you can carry guns into campuses in several states, and on the other hand you need to maintain this facade of law and order and put people in prison even if they didn't commit the crime. It's just contradictions of plenty.
Well, this is actually
a real honor for me to have these guys here because actually the last thing I experienced as an activist in Chicago, I moved here to go to school, and I'm in the Library and Information Science program, but all the libraries in your hand. So I made the right move. No, but before I left, one of the last memories I have actually was Marvin and his co-defendant Ronnie getting out of prison. And you know, you sit there in a room full of a room of eight people, if anybody has an experience doing that, and you know, you're talking about how do you make the flyer, and you know, you organize these protests, and you know, sometimes they're good. We had protests in Chicago of a couple hundred people, you know, at one point. And then sometimes it's like 30 people and you're holding signs and you're standing in front of the state's attorney's office. But to hear like Marvin saw some of those protests, and I didn't personally know, but that means so much that what we do to on the outside and what the guys do on the inside. And then, you know, it took years and years, but the Attorney General's office eventually dropped the charges.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, after a while, these people get sick of having to deal with you. And
mm-hmm.
you don't know when that's going to be, and you don't know how it's going to happen. But what we do matters. And it could be around this issue, or it could be around a different issue. But the key is, I think, just for people to take that first step and just figure out, like, what's wrong in the world and how are we going to get together in a room and start to change it? Because once you start to do that, it also just opens your eyes to just so much more that's wrong in this society. And, you know, from the war in Afghanistan to 2 million people in prison to our broken down education system, there's just so much that needs to be fixed. And we need, you know, I think just a fundamental transformation of the society. So I'm glad so many people are here. So please, you know, get involved with one of the groups that are here.
I first wanted to say thanks to the group for hosting this, because I'm a white kid that grew up in a very white neighborhood, and, you know, I saw this poster in class one day, and I've been against the death penalty since I probably first learned about it in fifth grade or so, but it was very, very cool to get to see a completely new side of the death penalty that I actually was not fully aware of. I had an idea, but not just, you know, just to such a significant degree. But my question was, actually, I know there's a lot of new ethics questions about looking back through old cases with the new technology that we have today. You know, some people are very in favor of all this new DNA testing that we have done, and, you know, that the this new reliance on, you know, sophisticated lie detector tests. Is there a overall positive, you know, is there a positive response to this kind of technology? Is it too questionable?
I'll answer that for. It's very positive, because what it has did, literally, look at all the individuals who were accused of rapes that have literally walked out of prison. These men was accused of rapes. And now it's turning out they didn't commit these crimes. Prosecutors jumped up and down. Judges followed what the prosecutor said. And some of these men, they just suffered while in prison. So, hey, it's great.
Let me say this here. 21 years, the victim husband, in my case, came to court for 21 years. We had a federal judge say that everybody involved with this case gonna take a DNA test. The husband was a suspect first, before they came and got me and my rapper. Me and my rapper took the DNA test. Wasn't none of us. He took the DNA test, and when we went to court, he never showed up again. But mind me, every day for 21 years, he's sitting in that front room in that courtroom.
When that DNA test come up, he wasn't nowhere to be found. He knew that he had killed his family, and we were sitting in jail for it. DNA is like the finger of God pointing at you.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't even have to be DNA. Prosecutors and cops lie all the time. One of the cases I worked on a lot in Chicago was the case of Michael Pardue, who was went to jail in the 1970s in Alabama for a murder he didn't commit. And the cops came to his uncle's house, found a rusty, cobwebbed old shotgun in the house, took it out, cleaned it up, fired it, and then presented it at the trial as the murder weapon.
Oh.
They never found the other murder weapon. Now, Michael took a different activist role in getting out of prison, even though he's innocent. He escaped three times from different prisons in Alabama. And, you know, he went to jail as a youth, and he wasn't considered, you know, a super predator back in the 70s. This was before things got much more terrible in the 80s as far as how we classified prisoners. And he worked on low-security farms and things like that. So he was able to escape a couple of times, but they finally brought him back. And even in the early 90s, when they knew Michael was innocent beyond a doubt, they kept him in prison. Who knows why? Because he had escaped. Because he knew he was innocent, and he fought for his innocence the only way he knew how. And that was to escape. I'm glad to say that Michael's been out for 10 years now. But, you know, and it's because of activists like us and people in Alabama, people around the world, Michael's case was an international news phenomenon that Michael got out. But when you talk about stolen lives, Mickey and I had a chance to visit with Michael 10 years ago now. He was completely taken aback by something that we take as for granted, even in the early 2000s, as a debit card.
Mm-hmm.
As any technology that wasn't a typewriter in the 1970s that, you know, that you go up to a gas pump, put the card in, drive away, it's like you've never paid. Because there's no reform in prisons anymore. I mean, that went out in the 80s. You know, thinking that people would have a life after prison? Because it's lock them up, throw away the key, forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about what happens when they get out. What happens? How do we help them get a life? And they completely ignore that.
I have a question. How lucrative is the business of keeping people in prison? Because I heard that like they make a lot of money by keeping those cells filled constantly.
Billions of dollars.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak as an organizer on this campus that I've been organizing for 4 or 5 years here, how important what we do here in the now really does matter, because there was a case 2 or 3 years ago of Kenneth Foster, who was on death row in Texas. And here we organized petitions across the quad, across the campus, and we sent them into the Texas state legislator. And Kenneth Foster was actually removed from death row by this governor of the Supreme Court of Texas. And that just the small victories in here and the now matter, because I think if we see ourselves on this campus as just sort of this isolated in our own rooms here at Gregor Hall, we're going to be isolated. But if we're actually part of a broader struggle for social justice in this country, I think it's absolutely important that we get involved. And that's why I joined the ISO and want to encourage people, too, to come talk, just check out our literature table as well. But I think just organizing on this campus for 4 or 5 years, I've seen the meetings across the board, whether it be the Green Party, the death penalty, just get bigger and bigger. Because I think the society we're living in right now, with the bank bailouts, with everything else that's going on, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, what happened in Haiti, aid workers aren't even allowed to get in. The U.S. has sent to occupy Haiti. It's now become officially the 51st state of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to get involved now. So that's all I just want to say. What we do in here now does actually matter.
Can I ask where the sign-up sheet is?
The one that I
didn't
pass.
Yes, right here. I got it.
Sorry.
I got it.
And can we have a last round of funds?
I just want to say that what happened up in Chicago isn't over either.
Mm-hmm.
Illinois has the TAMS maximum security prison where they do torture people. And sometimes it's just solitary confinement for long periods of time, which is mentally disturbing. It can drive people crazy just by being in solitary, and they do this on a regular basis, but there are also other things that happen there. So Illinois is still guilty of having, of torturing people down in TAMS. And also, just here in Champaign County, at the jail here, that some guards were actually, the inmates were handcuffed and in a chair, and they were tasering them, and they were found guilty of doing this, but then the guards don't go to jail because even though they committed a crime, they don't go to jail, they just get fired or demoted or things like that. And so things like, and of course, the things that were mentioned earlier with Jay Sean still being charged for things and kids getting shot or even the Champaign police keeping a database, just walking down the street and saying, you're black, I want to put you in my database, just so that I have your information or your DNA just because you're black. And that's not, it's happening right here, right now. We need to stop it. So, sorry.
Just to discuss, you know, what's you know, what's been going, what Brian talked about, what's been going on in Champaign. There's a lot of discussion in the News Gazette and things like this about whether it was an accident, you know, whether it was an accident or not, and this kind of rhetoric, I think, hides the fact that it's not an accident that you know, we live in a racist society, like that we have even in Champaign-Urbana, you know, it's segregated. I mean, there's and that segregation is you know, an issue that we face not only in just our communities, but in our schools. And so I think that there's all these ways that the police, for example, or the court system try to divert our attention from, like, the real issue, like, the gun, you know, obviously the gun should not have been drawn in the first place. North Champaign, which is the predominantly lower working class black neighborhood, is over patrolled by police, and so, you know, I just wanted to say that you know, I think we all here know that segregation still exists, and that you know, we really have to, in order to fight it, we have to get involved. And I just also wanted to say, just to let people know, new copy of The Socialist Worker just came out today. So if you're interested in checking one out, on the way out, we ask a dollar donation. But it talks about the school system, the economy, and
Hi, my name is Melissa Plano, and I just want to personally thank you guys for sharing your stories. I think being on campus here, so many students are very limited to what knowledge we receive. We're very limited. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what's going on in our own backyards. Mm-hmm. And the issues extend beyond just university, mm-hmm. but it also is global. Just like Andrew mentioned, it is an issue of institutions mm-hmm. Capitalizing off of low-income and black communities. And I think this is something that we need to understand, is that these stories are not only micro. These stories are something that is really representative of what's going on nationally and globally. And so again, I really want to thank you so much for putting the face for sharing your stories, because I think this is something that I wish students, professors, and here, you know, this should be something that at the fall and journey, everybody should here, because your voice and your stories mean so much. So I'm going to thank you for these tours that you're going through, like, throughout the nations. Again, thanks.
You know, life has its best, and maybe I see things that y'all don't see, because I've been in the belly of the beast, and maybe y'all don't know. They say those are correctional facilities. Guess what? They not. They create monsters that they gonna have to let go. And they putting them in y'all neighborhood. Y'all should be alarmed about that. Because you not safe, your kids not safe, and your parents not safe. That's what they doing. They breed monsters in that penitentiary. I'm just lucky. I got somebody to care about me. The way I'm able to walk with my head high. Like I say, it's a reason why I come out and do these tours, because y'all make me feel like I'm human again. I don't have to be that monster that was in that penitentiary. I was telling them a story about a guy I know that did 27 years. His mother died and left him $13,000. The lawyer came down to Bernard Correctional Center to see him and told him to give somebody a power of attorney until he got out. He gave it to his uncle and his wife. And I looked up and seen him 3 months later, back in Bernard. He had killed his uncle and his wife. Because they messed over the only thing that he hated. He had nothing else. And that's the type of monsters that prison create. Them some angry guys. And a lot of them coming back to society. Over 1 million people locked up in Illinois. A lot of them coming back. And they ain't. Because the prison is not doing the job that they're supposed to do. Like you say, they beating and torturing them guys. And when they get out of jail, they ain't. Who else they gonna take their problems out on? The closest to them. They'll put them people in y'all neighborhood and say, well, we ain't got no place else to put them. They did their time. What you want to do, lock them back up? Y'all don't know that they're not teaching them guys nothing. The only thing they're doing is breeding others, fighting every day, stabbing every day. And they bring that same mentality back to society because that's the only way they know how to survive. And them politicians know. And they study land in their pockets. It don't take but $18,000 to educate a person. But to keep a man in jail, it costs millions. Wow, that sounds backwards to me.
Okay, well, just to piggyback off of that, you know, I did some research on recidivism and educational programs in prison, and what he said is absolutely true. Well, Mark knows this too, because when he was younger, they did have some educational services, and they all got cut, and under Clinton, they all got cut. So when you look back at, I can't remember that movie. I don't know if anybody's seen it, but it shows them graduating, prisoners graduating from having higher education in prison, going through different programs. And what they found was is that the single best thing that will prevent recidivism and prevent people from committing another crime when they go back into the community are educational programs in prison. They know it. It's exactly what he said. They know it. And yet they cut all the money to it. And basically it becomes a political maneuver because they want to look like they're tough on crime. They want a posture. And so they say, we're going to be tough on the criminal. They're not going to be sitting back and getting some college-educated program, which things that you have to pay for, then we're going to. So it just, it ends up being that kind of mentality. So I do think that if you look, you know, in this country, what's happened is there isn't, you know, a sense of helping people out. It isn't. It's just about it's about penalizing people. It's about creating more violent people that then go back into society. And you do see really high levels of recidivism of people going back and back to prison.
You know, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, said, you know, they divide us both to conquer each. And I think we have to think about that. As people were saying, it's like, what role does prison and the death penalty and these repressive tools, what do they serve in our society? I think we have to try to dig out some of those questions. And I think it's important for us today to use this as a stepping stone also to look back and read about history, read about resistance to in various different struggles. Because they I do believe that they do divide us both to conquer each. If you look at the way society is set up, you know, why is it, you know, I was going to try to read, I can't now, but they mentioned Adolfo Davis. He did, you know, we have to talk about the guilty too. Yes, they raised the question of innocence, but it is true. He was 14 years old. He joined a gang. Why do people join gangs? Well, I say the biggest gang is in the White House, but, you know that they commit, you know, crimes of illegal war and never mind plundering our country and so on. But anyway, he joined a gang and he writes letters about, you know, why is it that I joined this gang? And yes, I did. I was involved in some of this stuff. Why is it that kids are set up to fail? And then when they do exactly what they're set up to do with crappy schools, poor education, you know, segregation and so on, they do what they're set up to do, which is commit a crime, join a gang, and then they end up in prison, and then it's the revolving door. And I think a different kind of society that didn't have police cars roaming around, but had social workers roaming around that really wanted to help people, you know. I don't think people are born that way. We create them in the kind of throwaway society that has everything for the rich and nothing for those, for other people, or make it very, very difficult. And I think, you know, they divide us to make us look down on the prisoner, look down on the welfare person, look down on the immigrant, instead of joining together and recognizing, you know what, they're making out here. We need to start to organize. We need to start to organize and say no more. It is not going to have any of that. And I'll just, I know I've spoken too long, and I'll end on this. But Sicko, there's that movie, Sicko. I was telling these guys about it. It's that great movie that Michael Moore made. And one of the things that he said is, like, why is it, you know, in other countries, you know, you look at France and these other countries where, you know, people there, where they have national health care is what his point was, why the thing that you see that's so different about the United States versus there is that in Europe, the governments are afraid of the people. But here, the people are afraid of the government. And it's kind of true. They are. In France and stuff like that, if they tried to do, like, make cuts in CTA or cuts in social services and stuff like that, people get out on the street and they demonstrate. They hold demonstrations. If they would try to take away national health, they would be out in droves shutting down the rail systems or whatever. You're not going to do it. So they're fearful of making those changes. That's why they have great educational packages, 5 weeks of paid vacation and so on. You know what I mean? Things that we don't have in this country. There has been an onslaught of their side on the working class and working people in this country for way too long. You know what I mean? Unions are weak and so on. Our side absolutely has to take the first steps around criminal justice, but lots of different issues in order to fight back and make some changes on lots of different issues. Green Party, whatever. We need that progressive force out there. Come on, didn't that get a clap?
I guess I just wanted to briefly say, in terms of some of the historical things that have been said, the Attica prison riot in 1971, there's an episode in the series Eyes on the Prize about that. So I would recommend running that and watching it and learning about the Rockefeller drug laws in New York State that are the reverberations still exist there. Just as one thing of what we're living in.
The Last Graduation, that's the name of the movie. I just remembered it, the one about the prison education. It's brilliant.
For people that are interested, the university actually has an education. It's an education justice project. We offer upper level college courses at Danville Prison, and they need tutors and helpers. It's called the Education Justice Project.
Marvin will say a few last words and then we'll end the discussion.
I'd like to say this here, that today's prison is not nothing but modern day slavery for the unfortunate. I like that. Anybody answer this question for me? They say a key of cocaine costs $35,000. I'd like to know how a poor person on government assistance, living in a project, afford a key of cocaine. I said the same thing. Wow. You know, I had somebody ask me that question, and I couldn't even answer because I don't know. Only solution that I came up with is it has to be given to me because you can't afford it. Understand, I'm from the old school, and I watched how they create problems through racism. I've watched it for years because when the blacks and the Spanish move in the neighborhood, the whites move out with the grocery stores. Ain't no jobs. Man gonna do what he gotta do to feed his family. Not only do you become the prey, you become the predator. This is what our society creates when they do what they do. But y'all gonna go up and get out of college and go on with y'all life, and hopefully y'all remember this lesson. Mm-hmm. And change position, make a change. You got a voice. Mm-hmm. And wrong is wrong. I don't care where you at. You can be over in you can be over in Hong Kong. You can be over in Iraq. Wherever you at, wrong is wrong. Right is right. Never change. I thank y'all for having me, and y'all are beautiful crowd.
I want to thank you all again for coming. Some of us are going to be going to Murphy's Pub on Green Street for a more informal discussion. So please join us.
Murphy's Bar for more discussion. That sounds like getting drunk.
That too.
Oh, thank you.
Thank
you.
Oh, great. Awesome. Thanks, everybody.
Okay,
I know it ain't my